Aren't you a technology supplier looking for deal flow? Then you should try our new platform, Connect. It's designed to help buyers and brands find the best tech solutions to match their campaign requirements. It's free for buyers to use and for tech suppliers to set up an account and start applying to campaign briefs. Set up your account today by visiting exchangewire.com/connect or email us at info@thewirecorp.com.
The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire. Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the MadTech Podcast.
I'm Rachel Smith, COO of ExchangeWire. I feel like I have to introduce myself because I've had a couple of weeks hiatus and left the podcast in the capable hands of my colleagues, whom I'll introduce in a moment. Allow me in the first instance to introduce our special guest for today's session, who is Harvan Gupta, Director of Solutions Engineering at Xandr, and very importantly, AdTech Rising Star for 2020. Hello, Harvan.
Hello, Rachel. How's it going?
Yeah, really good. Thanks. Harvan, I was really delighted to hear you say that winning Rising Star was one of the highlights of the year for you last year.
It was, the highlight of the year of a year with very few highlights on.
That's exactly what I said. The bar's a bit low. But anyway, it was well-deserved, well-deserved award, and just a bit of a shame we couldn't celebrate in person.
But I know.
And joining me in the co-host seat, my trusty colleague, and ExchangeWire CEO, Kieran O'Kane. How you doing?
Morning, Rachel.
Still How sporting very well, thank you. Still sporting your Gordon Gekko hairdo. Kieran has definitely got a lockdown hairdo going on. Really needs a little bit of a visit to the barbers.
Yes, it's a tragedy that nobody can see this haircut. Probably a good thing, in fairness.
Don't worry, we'll get a photograph of you, Kieran, so everyone can appreciate the delights of your hairdo. Right, let's get cracking. First story was a nice piece written in The Information this week about the rise in popularity of AVOD, so ad-supported video on demand. We've talked a lot on certainly this podcast and at ExchangeWire events about the world of connected TV and video streaming and SVOD versus AVOD. We've talked about it from a business models perspective. But what's really interesting is this piece goes into some detail about a study that was recently undertaken by Deloitte that shows a significant increase in the numbers of subscriptions to AVOD services, to the extent that this goes beyond the expectations of AVOD streaming providers, and really sets up a bit of a picture as this being somewhat competitive to subscription offerings. Amazon's AVOD, IMDb TV tripled their subscribers last year to 55 million. Still a sort of a modest number of subscribers in comparison to our big, SVOD incumbents, but tripling the number of subscribers within a year is pretty impressive. It talks a little bit about the demographics of AVOD viewers, saying that it's obviously a more popular medium for younger people, perhaps, who are more budget conscious and also arguably a little more tolerant of advertising, since they're, often that's a demographic that's a keen consumer of YouTube, which contains a lot of adverts. So interested in your views on the piece, interested in your views on AVOD versus SVOD. Are we going to actually see that AVOD services might give SVOD services a run for their money? And also maybe something about what that might mean from the content point of view, because we know that SVOD services are known for investing a lot of the money that they generate via subscriptions into original content. Where does that put AVOD content in comparison? And I guess also a final word on what it means for the advertising industry. That's about 10 million questions in one. Harvan, over to you.
So when I was reading the article, it got me thinking about my own consumption of TV, especially over the last of the pandemic. And I think when the pandemic first started, I was just hooked on Netflix and watched everything on Netflix. Now I'm sort of a little bit bored of Netflix, and I'm going for a little bit more of the kind of more obscure niche content. And that's driven me more towards AVOD, where there's a bit more of a long tail. So last week I got really into sort of Italian neorealism films in black and white. And actually I don't want to just watch the kind of fancy series on Netflix. I want something a bit different. So I think that's why there's a space for AVOD. It's as people start to want to consume more and more niche content, they're going to be drawn to services like that. I've already got a Netflix subscription, I've got an Amazon Prime subscription, I've got Sky Sports, I'm paying my BBC license fee. I don't really want to take on another subscription I don't think I can afford it. It's not something I want to do, but I do want to have access to a lot more content. So I think it doesn't surprise me that there's been this growth in AVOD.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point of view, actually, that you could see it as complementary to use to your other subscription services. Kieran?
It's something we've been talking about for a while at Exchange Wire, writing about on exchangewire.com and talk about on podcasts, that there is going to be a subscription fatigue, right? It's interesting, I haven't mentioned that, and that, you know, Disney obviously has had massive growth this year. Netflix has massive growth, but they're going to top off because people, there's only so many people who will pay for that. And there's only so many people who are prepared to pay for sub-based channels or SVOD. Because it just, because money's not infinite. Like, you know what I mean? It's like there's things you want. You know, you want Disney Plus if you want access to all of that back catalog and IP, or you have kids or whatever. And you want Netflix because Netflix is a general sort of catch-all channel or streaming channel for a variety of interests, documentaries, comedies, you know, films, series, whatever. But there is a cutoff point, I think, for most people, and saying, I can't afford another 10 subscriptions. I don't want to pay for another 10 subscriptions. I myself pay for Now TV because I might want access to sports on a certain weekend. Maybe the golf is on or rugby or whatever. I dip in and out of it, right? That's great. And I suspect a lot of people will be that way as well. So I'm not surprised that AVOD is making, you know, is growing. You know, some of the channels like Pluto and Tubi and all that is kind of semi-garbage-esque. It's kind of like the bottom of the barrel stuff. But they do have some good programs, and it'll get better. But it's obviously a good indication that advertising-funded content is going to make a comeback, right? So ITV obviously has its own streaming service. You know, there's various channels, like Channel 4 that have its own streaming service as well, and they're doing very well. You know, I mean, for instance, Cheltenham's on this week, and it's, you know, it's obviously you can't go watch it in person, so everybody's watching on TV, and we're watching it and streaming some of it on our afternoon gambling expertise exploits. So you know, that's just an example of that. But I do think that this is going to grow. I think we're going to see more ad-funded channels appear. I think that I think the economics of subscription is going to work to a certain degree, but then it's going to be carried a lot more by ads. And it's great for, I guess, great for Xandr, obviously. Great for other vendors who work in that space, CTV. This is a big play for them. I mean, Jeff Green has been talking about this as well, about he believes that this is going to be a massive growth area. And he certainly didn't think that streaming would be the only way that content would be distributed to people, like paid for behind paywalls or whatever. So it is, I'm not surprised this happened. And the younger demographic is very interesting as well.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. The younger demographic, and, you know, hard to reach audiences. There's some audiences that simply aren't using linear TV, you know, and the only way to get them is through CTV environments. So that makes a lot of sense. One of the things that worries me a little bit is just discovery. So as we're getting more and more of these platforms, you know, I find it hard to find the content I want, and I don't want to constantly be switching out of one app into another app, looking for one. And often the user experience on the apps isn't as good as it could be as well. So I think that's something that needs to be solved.
Do you think that's a play for someone like Roku, Harman? Is it, if you could build a discovery channel, if you will, and it's kind of like sucking data, and then you might like this, but obviously Roku obviously wants you to watch stuff in Roku, unfortunately, because that's how they make money.
Yeah.
But is there a way to independently go, that's the point, how do you pull out that data and then have like a discovery piece? Because I think that's the one thing missing here. Like, you know, what should I watch now? Like, there's, you know, Cambodian, you know, chicken fighting on whatever channel it is. That's a missing piece. That people talk about this. That discovery piece is really important. But how do you, like, would Roku allow anybody to kind of access that data so that you could have a recommendation channel? You should watch this now. You like this. You might. I mean, I suppose Netflix is kind of in their platform.
But it's almost like you need a sort of like a radio time, like a sort of digital version of a Radio Times, exactly. You know, or a TV guide, right? Because that's how we used to discover content before, was either we read about it independently via articles and reviews, or we consulted the TV guide.
Well, even just a global search as well. So, you know, if there's a particular film or series that I want to watch, I'd love if I could just go somewhere, type it in, and it'll tell me which platform to go to, and then I could just deep link directly to that show, rather than having to search through every single platform, be like, oh, it's not on there, okay, I'll open the next one up.
If it's user experience, yeah, that's a good idea. Like, what are you interested in? We'll tell you if it's where you can get it. And I'm sure Roku wouldn't object to that. It was just an app going, what to watch now?
Making an app out of that would be a fantastic solution, especially that's one brilliant. On your telly, obviously, because I just use Google search for that, and it does work, right? We've potentially come up with a new business model there. Somebody just needs to dive in and provide it.
There's come talk to First Party Capital.
There's one app that I'd love to see, which is what I was thinking about. It's almost like Tinder, but for content. So when you're watching TV with other people and you're like sort of having a bit of a disagreement about what you're going to watch, and you see all the shows and you swipe for the ones that you're interested in, and as soon as you both hit a match, that's what you watch. And I think that would solve a lot of arguments.
That is a great idea. That's two. There you go, listeners, two business models there for you in the connected TV space. Right, moving us on to second news story of the week, a commentary on Google's announcement of nearly 2 weeks ago now that they will no longer be using third-party cookies to track user behavior in their own browser and ecosystem, and that they are not intending to replace those. Instead, they are supporting the alternative option of federated learning of cohorts, flocks. This commentary, which was written on Engadget, is actually quite a nice piece sort of looking at the perspective of personalized advertising, where personalized advertising goes from here. And the argument that they've put forward, that the authors put forward, is this isn't the end of personalized advertising. It's instead a call to arms for the industry to try to solve some of those long-standing issues. Furthermore, they raise some interesting issues, which is that, you know, Google, by sort of taking this position of we're going to do the right thing from a privacy perspective and trying to align themselves, at least from a, you know, from a PR point of view, with the likes of Apple and Firefox, who consider themselves to be very privacy first, have also sort of not really drawn too much attention to the fact that their cohort approach is much more likely to benefit anyone that's trying to advertise in a Google ecosystem, because they have so much access to first party data. And the argument goes that perhaps this is, for the cynics amongst us, this is a convenient way for Google to be addressing privacy issues and try to throw off, privacy regulator concerns and heat. But perhaps, you know, exchanging that with potentially some anti-competition criticism, because they're going to be naturally advantaged in an environment where they have access to a lot of first-party data. Of course, this is a massive issue for the industry in general, and there's been a lot of discussion about this over the last couple of weeks, but particularly interested in your point of view in terms of what the impact for the industry is going to be going forward, since we know that the other thing that this announcement by Google is set to focus on will be the fact that in a couple of years' time, it's quite likely that those workaround solutions that people are using at the moment to replace third-party cookies, some of those workaround solutions just won't be viable anymore. So, Harvin, you first.
Yes, I think it's really good for the industry that Google is now moving to a privacy-focused sort of stance. That's a positive way forward. There's a lot of misunderstanding around flocks, and I think the industry needs to learn a lot more about what that product's going to look like, how well it's going to function. Is it going to advantage Google, or is it actually going to be something that all of ad tech can benefit from? So I think there's a lot of unknowns there. For me, there's a lot of opportunity. The opportunities for the open internet, right? I think Google sort of, let's face it, they're going to protect YouTube, they're going to protect search, they're going to protect their core business. And for me, that's really exciting, because the areas Zander operates in, you know, we're champions of the open internet. So I think that represents a good opportunity for us. Where there's a slight sort of disagreement with the Google announcement is the space for industry identifiers. So Google said they're not going to support them. And it's important to note that that was an announcement from Google Ads and not from, from Chrome, right? But I actually think that there's a lot of space for these industry IDs. I think the ones that are privacy safe, the ones that are grounded in consent, the ones that are GDPR compliant, I think that's where the opportunity arises. That allows the open internet to kind of innovate and differentiate from what Google's doing. Kieran, I'm sure you're going to have some pretty strong opinions on this.
Well, but I mean, you know, I don't want to preempt because Kieran will no doubt make himself very clear. But, you know, you have said all along that you feel like this is also representation of the fact that this is one part of Google not necessarily aligning with another part of Google, as Harvin rightly points out. You know, the announcements come forward from Google Ads and not from the browser side of the business. Go on. I'm letting you off the leash.
Well, I think that was a very, very good overview of what's happening, right? So I think that Google Ads made that announcement, but I would safely say they're being backed up 100% by the Google Browser team, because it's probably what Google Browser team wants to do anyway. So Google will look after Google. What I like about Flock is that it's effectively Google's new religion on how to measure the open internet, right? Through Google's view. Now, I don't want the industry to be piling into Flock and giving Google the currency to run the table for the next decade. What we need to do is push back against Flock. And I think this is a great opportunity for us as independent ad tech and independent digital media to move away from the Google view of the internet, right? They got to dictate what the internet was for the last 15, 20 years. Like, the click is everything, right? It's time for us to kind of walk away from that. I know it's going to be hard because a lot of the ecosystem is kind of built on top of Google, right? And it is interesting that, you know, we have this opportunity now to reimagine. And I think measurement is the issue here, right? It's not targeting, because I think that between the clean rooms and I think between contextual and semantic targeting, I think there's a real opportunity to do good targeting, right? It doesn't have to be cookie-based, followed around the internet. You can infer so much from the pages that people visit anywhere that you can build a profile. And I don't mean fingerprinting, because it's all privacy first. Mm. What's important here is measurement, right? And that's the part we need to nail, right? If we get measurement right for the open internet in a way that everybody can use in a privacy first way, we will have won this war against Google and all the walled gardens, because it's very true, right? Google are going to look after their own, right? They're going to look after search, Gmail, YouTube, because they can take 100% margin. The open internet and third-party ad tech and third-party advertising doesn't fit the Google investor narrative of hyper-growth, high-margin business. They want to have control. They want to solidify their position. They want to take 100% margin. They want to grow YouTube, make more money, because Google's a machine, right? They have to have billion, you know, they have to go after multi-billion dollar businesses. And that sort of business that they are involved in via the DoubleClick acquisition and AdMail and Invite just isn't sexy enough for investors. Google's looking at gaming and health. These are like the big businesses that will be, you know, like the ultimate thing is Google is going to get broken up anyway, because they can't get that big without causing, you know, too many problems. They're all in the crosshairs, even Apple with their recent privacy crusade.
Falling out with the Chinese government.
I think Apple are in a real trouble. I know that's not a story there, but that for me was the best story of the week. The Chinese just thumbing their nose at Apple. Can you imagine how, if they let that go, right, in China, right? Oh, yeah, the Chinese can do whatever they want. Can you imagine Republicans and Democrats? You know, they would – that's the one thing that unifies those two delineated parties is China. Can you imagine them giving the advantage to Chinese just to U.S. Companies?
It's a fascinating story, but not on the agenda for discussion this week.
I'm just saying, it all
– steering you right back away from that.
But it all, yeah, I'm sorry, I love digressing, but it all fits into the privacy narrative, right? I think this is kind of almost blowing up in the faces of these big companies. And while they're all trying to you know, oh yeah, privacy. There is an alter, you know, there's another agenda, right? They're trying to, you know, build businesses and almost, so there's a term called rentier capitalism, right? Which is basically, you know, it's like, think about it, like feudal landlords that just basically make money off rent from the serfs that work on their land. We're seeing a trend like this from GAFA, right? They've built these platforms. They don't innovate in this space for 15 years. They just buy companies. They bought DoubleClick. They bought AdMeld. They bought Invite. They bought YouTube. I mean, most of the companies that are that give them the strength and this control, they bought AdSense as well. What am I talking about? They bought the company behind AdSense. Literally all the best businesses in Google, apart from search, are all bought.
Yeah, I think you said some really interesting things there. I'm not sure about pushing back on Flock. I think Flock is just, it's one part of the solution. And I think there is space for it, but that's not the entire solution. I think if you look at the Google announcement, it looks like they're saying that is kind of the be all and end all. And I don't think that's the case, but there's definitely room for it. I don't think there's one silver bullet, and it's under what we're trying to do is cover all bases. So I think that's important. You talked about measurement, and I completely agree. But what's interesting is, in my opinion, measurement is one of the most broken bits of this industry already. And the opportunity to move away from last touch attribution driven by a cookie, I think that's great, because that's the bit of the industry that, in my mind, really doesn't work and needs to be solved for. I'm excited to see what comes next. I'm excited to see what things that we can measure that sort of show engagement, that show impact, that show return on investment, that aren't tied to a cookie. And I think there's going to be a lot of innovation in that space. The other thing I'm really excited about is publisher-provided IDs. Anything that puts power back to publishers, for me, like, that's my background. I started my first ever job at a publisher, and I think that's really important. So I think a big part of the Xander solution is, how can we support publishers with their first-party IDs and passing those down through the supply chain?
Yeah, we've talked quite a bit at Exchange Row about how this, certainly Google's most recent announcement and in general developments in the industry over the last 6 months or so, is really putting control back into the hands of publishers, and that can only be a good thing. We're huge fans of that here at Exchange Wire as well. Kieran, I don't know if there's anything more that you wanted to say on, because I think Harvin's point of view around there not being a silver bullet is really important. And I know that measurement is the part of the industry that you think is pretty broken too. I don't know if there's anything else that you want to add there, because I guess what we're all hoping for is seeing some exciting new solutions coming forward and things that are actually really being adopted, in a practical sense, in an operational sense. Any view from you on that, Kieran?
I think what we'll see happening now is a wave of new startups appearing that will address some of these problems. I think measurement needs to be an industry-wide discussion about what metrics need to be applied. And I think that's a good point about Google. Google's pushed that last touch attribution model, right? Post click model that they built their entire DR business, independent industry, to kind of like build something new around measurement. And obviously, there's loads of great companies who are doing stuff around clean rooms and contextual and all that kind of stuff. We'll see loads of new companies who are going to be addressing that part of the business. It's exciting. It's great. It's great to see as well.
Quite useful sort of prelude to the final story. Immediately, not directly connected, but this is a nice little piece that we picked up earlier on this week in Modern Retail about the perspective of marketers as they try to use and apply data. And what it talks about, it highlights, so, you know, sort of three of what the author sees as the main challenges the marketers are facing on a day-to-day basis when they're trying to make use of customer data. This article in Modern Retail talks about three main challenges for marketers when it comes to data. The first is being able to verify the sources of data and having some trust in those sources, and that it's quite common that marketers will come across volumes of data or have data that will be, you know, retrieved from various parts of the business over the years, but they might not necessarily trust the validity of that data, and so then it goes unused and effectively becomes redundant. The second challenge that they noted is that then that means that quite oftentimes the right amount of time and resource isn't put into how to actually make the data that's available to marketers within a business usable, that actually that's not always a straightforward task. It's quite time consuming, and you need to actually, you know, dedicate some resource to that and spend some time really funneling through that data and analyzing it properly and working out what it's telling you and what you can actually use it for. And that also those time constraints are exactly the sorts of things that often make marketers shy away from using high volumes of data, because they're in a hurry, and they're they know that actually getting to grips with an analysis of data can take time. And then that leads on to the third challenge, which is that in the absence of reliable data and or time to apply to making sense of that data, executing it appropriately, marketers have a tendency, I think as all professionals do, to rely on instinct, and that then leads to potentially poor decision making. And I just thought that this was a really nice way to articulate the challenge that marketers are probably facing in their jobs on a day-to-day basis. There's obviously lots of technology tools and solutions available to try to help marketers navigate their way around their data, but I just wanted a perspective from both of you on that as quite a basic set of challenges, and how we actually address that as an industry from the perspective of providing technology tools and solutions, but also from the point of view of understanding what it is that marketers are facing. Harvin?
Yeah, it's hard. And I've had a lot of conversations with brands about, you know, how can they understand their data? I think we're moving to a period now where first party data is going to be super valuable. Really worth having that conversation. You know, it's a hard conversation to have. We have more regulation in this industry than we've ever seen before. There's an impetus to, you know, use that data carefully and wisely. But I think also that data is super valuable. But what I'm seeing is a lot of brands, they've built up data over many, many years. There might be companies that have merged, so data exists in lots of different places. The consented data, the non-consented data, the kind of grey area data, that's all mashed together. You've got use of different identifiers across different parts of the business. So it is a really hard conversation, but there's so much value in that data, especially as we move to this kind of post-cookie world where you can't just target an audience segment and activate against it. So I think this needs to be something that brands are taking really seriously. It needs to become like a management issue. You know, they need to be monitoring, developing strategies, doing data audits, and importantly, finding partners to work with that can help them think through these kinds of problems. Finding partners that are kind of aligned with their way and their worldview. And partners that have the expertise to help them think through these things. Because if they can get it right, it means they can have these really valuable conversations with the right audiences at the right time. And you know, that's what advertising's about, right?
I mean, I wonder if it's also going to give birth to a new wave of data tools and solutions. I don't know, Kieran, if you're seeing any innovation coming through from a data management point of view, even in some of the things that you might be looking at from an investment point of view at First Party Capital, because we know that any business that's any technology solution that is going to enable people to use and activate data is really valuable at the moment. So what are you seeing from your point of view, Kieran?
I think that this is a really hard problem to fix for a lot of companies. Cause like, you know, if you're not a lot of brands are data driven, they say they are, but they're not. They've got lots of data, but how do you make sense of it? I mean, the first part is interesting, verifying sources of data. Oh my God, that must be a nightmare, pulling pieces of data out of like, and find that whether or not they're going to work in different scenarios. Like, so I think like the data management or the data execution stack needs to be addressed, because there's lots of different things like CMPs and DMPs and CDPs and all sorts of like three-letter acronyms that kind of like cover that space. Probably need to consolidate into one, like some was they need to work with the CRM. So I think there's going to be a lot of innovation around that. The other thing which is very interesting is the actual data privacy piece, right? Is my data compliant with the GDPR or CCPA laws? Oh, global privacy law. So we actually are looking at one company in Denmark called Wold, which is kind of like addressing that, which is quite interesting. They pull in all the data and they say if it's compliant from a legal perspective, right? So which is very good from a brand, publisher, ad tech point of view, because you don't want to be caught in out by you know, a data privacy oversight committee in different jurisdiction that might be slapping a very substantial fine on your business. So there's a lot of issues there, and I can totally sympathize with brands. And Google, like, let's be honest, Google made it easy for people, right? It was one cookie measurement, cross-channel, cross-site measurement using a cookie. And now that's all gone. So you have to kind of rethink everything. And it's very important as well. The first-party data stuff is hugely important to organizations. But it's the effort, right? You gotta clean that data. You gotta build the right infrastructure. And then you got to execute it. Like, so you got to figure out where you're going to use it, where you're going to use it, how you're going to use it, and what you can continuously test. And it is important to reiterate that point that it needs to be like something at the board level rather than like pushed down to a bunch of like data scientists or data analysts who kind of like are five rungs down from the board. Data first world, right? Your data is it's almost like an asset for many people, right? For many companies, yeah. That is.
And maybe that's actually the advantage of all of the legislation that's associated with the handling of and management of data now, is that because that's a legal requirement, you might find that elevates the people responsible within organizations to board level, by necessity.
Just one last point. I think this is where the service layer becomes interesting, right? So I actually think that the next 10 years, we're going to see an evolution in that space. I think, you know, with the death of the holding group has been predicted many, many times, but I think that model will evolve, right? Because this becomes even more important, right? So you think like the legacy business that the holding group has will be kind of like shelled, and they will move more towards this upstream, upriver, like tech-based sort of service or service offering, where they're able to tell the brand about these various things, advise them on. I guess this is where the Accenture and all those guys want to be, but they're not going to be able to just do a feckin' PowerPoint presentation. Someone's going to get it. This is hands-on. This is a dirty job, like, and it's going to be really hard to get in there.
So that was actually what I was going to throw back to you on, Harvin, is from your experience of some of the brands that you're working with, to what extent, what kind of levels of support do you think that brands need to navigate their way around all of this fragmentation? Connects a little bit to Kieran's comment about the service layer.
Yeah, loads, absolutely loads. So different brands are at different stages of that journey. My sort of request would be, make sure you start that journey now if you haven't started it already, because it's going to be important. Don't leave it until the last minute. I completely agree with what Kieran's saying about service. Service is going to be like the consulting around how to think through data is going to be super important. Tech to make this easy as well. You know, I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done. Things like clean rooms, they're great, but the sort of activation layer as well, connecting those clean rooms to the ad tech ecosystem and kind of bridging that gap. Things about creating scale, that's going to be super important. How do you battle fragmentation and fragmented data sets? I think tech and ad tech can play a role there. So, but for me, where this gets exciting is, and the opportunity is, how can you use that data to build a really highly differentiated strategy? Because today, like you said, it's very easy just to target a cookie, and that's fine. But your competitors are targeting that same cookie, and everyone's targeting that same audience. So how do you outperform the market? How do you get more bang for your buck if you're just doing what everyone else is doing? The opportunity is that, and if brands can figure out and, you know, work with consultancies, work with tech to figure out a way of taking their unique data and putting that at the heart of a differentiated strategy, that's how you outperform the market, I think, and that's how you get the maximum value for your advertising budget.
Yeah, sets up a really interesting future, I think, for where we're going to go from a data point of view. Brings us on to second part of the podcast and perhaps somewhat connected, chat with you, Harvin, about what you're up to at Xander, and specifically wondering if you can tell me a little bit more about Xander Curate, which, of course, is, you know, a marketplace effectively that you've set up with Dentsu Aegis, but tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, so Xander Curate is actually one of the most interesting products I've worked on in a long time. And it's working, you know, like when I present this to marketers and when I present this to agencies, there's a real penny drop moment, you know, where they sort of, at first they don't quite get it. And now they're like, oh, right, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, we need that in our business. So when I talk about marketplaces, what we're getting at is this concept of, I think in the past, if you're an agency or a marketer, you've cared a lot about the DSP. So what DSP should I be using? What data segment should I be targeting? How should I be setting up my line items? These are all very sort of buy-side focused conversations. But the way the space has evolved, buyers are now starting to care much more about the sell side of the equation as well. So, you know, concepts like SPO, which SSP should I be buying through? What's the best path to supply? What does quality supply look like in a kind of commoditized world? These types of conversations are becoming more and more important to the buyers, to the buy side. And sometimes what this can look like is dumping a ton of complexity on the trader. And that's really the last thing you want to be doing because they've got enough to do already. So what we've done is built a suite of products that allow a marketer to build their marketplace. So they can basically start to think about questions like, what does quality look like to us? What's the most efficient path to supply for us? And then use a tool to build that rule set and to start to engage much more closely with the supply side. By building their marketplace. So this allows things like transparency. It allows concepts like curation, which is taking inventory and packaging it up into sort of meaningful buckets and passing that on before it hits the trader. And then also things like centralization. So having one place where you can build your macro business rules and report against them, that's not in the DSP. That's actually a place where they're supposed to live, a kind of a home for them that's designed to be that home.
I wonder if that is also then therefore giving buyers and marketers a greater sense of ownership, I suppose, or responsibility over that transaction. So like you said, it's not just bringing them a bit closer to the sell side. It's also giving them a bit more control. I'm not saying that control wasn't available to them before, but perhaps they weren't as familiar with the levers and with the various machinations of how bits and pieces of the supply chain operated.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me give you one really simple example. So let's say an agency decides their definition of quality or one of their aspects of quality is high viewability. So they say, right, we're going to implement a strategy where all the inventory we buy is 60% viewable. Well, how would you execute that? You'd have to execute it at the line item level in every single DSP for every one of your line items, for every one of your campaigns. That's where you set it up in the DSP on the line item. And then let's say you want to report against the effectiveness of that. Well, you've got to go into, and you might be using three or four different DSPs all around the world. You've got to log into all of those DSPs and start stitching together reports. Now let's say you've got a learning and you decide, okay, I want to change that. I want to move to 70% viewability. Then you've got to go into every single one of those line items and update them to reflect that. What curation allows and what building a marketplace allows the agency to do or the marketer to do is centralize all of that. So they can apply that business rule in one place. They can pull the reports from one place and then they can say, okay, we're going to change it to 70%. Okay, we make a change in one place and that's reflected across all line items in all DSPs. So that kind of speaks to, and that's kind of a really simple example, but you can start to apply the same concepts to the application of data to other aspects of quality.
Are you able to cut a cost though? I mean, like if I'm curating, like I'm just thinking about, so if you're like, if you use a DSP to integrate into Xander or even use Xander's DSP and you're curating quite a lot of the inventory, then you don't really need a bunch of intermediaries there. You could cut out maybe 15-20% of cost, which obviously affects the marketer in terms of more media they can buy.
Yeah, absolutely. facing working media. The other aspect is the transparency as well. So a good example is if you are using the Xandr DSP, Xandr Invest, and you're buying through one of these curated marketplaces, what you're able to do is account for every single penny of spend. So you can see, okay, how much spend did I put into the DSP? What was the DSP fees? What was the SSP fee? What was the publisher net and gross revenue? What was my working media? And how much money ended up in the publisher's hands? And you can do that for every single auction and start to account for that. And then that then in itself becomes an optimization tool, because you're able to say, okay, well, am I ensuring that I am using, am I using the path to supply that maximizes my working media? Also, there's just cost benefits of going all in on one kind of supply marketplace. You get the economies of scale in that way, so that drives down price as well.
And what about the perspective of the sell side? How are publishers finding the marketplace? What's the upside for them?
Yeah, so when we built the suite of tools, it was very important that we didn't take control away from publishers. Because if you did, ultimately, the publisher won't want to engage with this. The publisher doesn't necessarily want something, you know, something else to think through. So the first thing is the publisher still retains complete control. They can decide which curators, which marketplaces they want to be a part of and what they don't want to be a part of. They can still put floor rules in place. They can still package up their inventory. So what we're finding is actually publishers quite like this approach, because it just makes their inventory easier to be consumed by buyers. So by opting into an agency marketplace, they're seeing greater spend from that agency, because it's easier for that agency to target them. The other thing we've seen actually is publishers are starting to build their own marketplaces. So publishers are coming together, and we're actually seeing this at, all around Europe. Publishers are coming together to build coalitions, because what they're seeing is, well, we're losing out to Facebook and Google because that's where the scale is. And us as a smaller publisher, we don't have that scale. But if a couple of big publishers start to band together, then they're creating scale that's larger than what Facebook's able to offer. So we're actually seeing publishers using our curation tools to build their own marketplaces as well.
That's super interesting. That's really interesting. And did you say that was happening throughout Europe? So in a number of different marketplaces?
Yeah, so the one I was working on last year was one in Denmark. So we built a coalition that's Denmark-wide, and it's a lot of the largest publishers there are using the tools.
Got to rely on the Scandinavians for a bit of for a bit of innovation, right, Kieran? Kieran's always talking about how much he enjoys speaking to Scandinavian companies for when he's having investment conversations.
Yeah, it's the new centre of ad tech in Europe.
Love the Scandies.
Because their markets are a little bit smaller. So you know, you've got to work a lot harder to have impact and to generate significant amount of revenue. And that's why something like a coalition kind of starts to make sense as well.
Well, thanks very much. We've run out of time. It was delightful to have you on the podcast. And thank you very much, Kieran, for participating in your, I must say your ranting was fairly moderate today, which is great.
Yeah, I'm trying to, you know, rein it in a little bit.
Brilliant. We love nuanced Kieran. Thanks very much to both of you. And thanks everybody for listening. That was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.